As the rains have begun in Haiti and the public health disaster from these rains is impending, I talked last week to well-known Haitian-American author Edwidge Dandekat from Miami about the response of the Haitian-American community to this disaster. And I talked to activist and author Beverly Bell, who has been in Haiti for the past 3 months, working with the burgeoning grassroots Haitian movement that is developing in Haiti, trying to fight for their right to have a voice in the reconstruction of their country, and the role of women in Haiti and that new movement. Beverly, can you talk about the conditions under which many people are living today after the earthquake?
The conditions are despicable. In Port-au-Prince, there is an uncountable number of homeless people who have lost everything. The levels of poverty have augmented dramatically. That seems inconceivable, given the way Haiti was before, but in fact, it's true. And people everywhere are sleeping in the streets without so much as a tarp over their heads or a tent or even a bed sheet under their bodies. And now the rains have come. So it is raining pretty much all night long, every night. And people have nowhere even to sit. So they spend the night with all of their little children standing in the streets. And very, very little aid has reached anybody. It's quite remarkable. I travel all over the streets of Port-au-Prince pretty much every day. I have yet to see one act of food distribution. People living in many of the camps tell me that they have not received so much as one cup of rice or one little plastic bottle of water. It's really quite hard to tell where all of that aid is going, but it's certainly not going to the people. So there's really no way to overstate the difficulty of the physical conditions and lack of basic needs that are being met, and then all of that is on top of just tremendous, tremendous pain and suffering because everybody has lost at least one person, and many people have lost their entire families.
And people are talking about the upcoming rains leading to a public health disaster and flooding. What is the response of the government to this, and is there any response by the government?
The response is pathetic. What the Haitian government has said most recently is that they have turned away from tents, and now their effort is to get tarps for people, which is shocking to folks here because as inadequate as tents are, at least they are covered on the sides, whereas tarps, the rains just blow in, and at least in a tent, people, most notably would-be rapists and attackers, because there are many of those out, cannot see you. And now the Haitian government is saying that they are going to be asking people to return to their original neighborhoods, many of which were in the slums, because, of course, the poor have been disproportionately hit. And those places which people rented before, as horrible as they were then, are not even available now because their little plot is now covered with rubble and perhaps many bodies because there's been very little digging out there besides what folks could do with their own fingers since there was no assistance or little assistance. And furthermore, they don't own that plot of land, so they can easily be sent away. And the government of Haiti has told people that in terms of long-term housing, they should just pack up their tarps from the camps where many, many hundreds of thousands of people are now living in disgusting, horrible conditions, and that they should just take the tarp back home, that it's quite durable and can last several years as housing. A woman in one of the camps said to me yesterday, "What do they think we are, animals?" So fortunately, there has been no outbreaks yet of epidemics. I was just speaking with a Cuban doctor this afternoon, but what he was saying is that certainly as soon as the rain increases, we can expect cholera and many other waterborne diseases, and there is almost no response at all towards any of this from the government of Haiti.
Does there seem to be any coordination going on between the government of Haiti and the UN and the NGOs? And what is the cause of this chaos?
I am privy to the private meetings, but publicly there is almost nothing that is being said. It's really shocking. USAID, for example, has said that it's taking a week break in food distribution. It is about to start the second phase of its distribution, but that won't commence for a week. And so for 1 week, whatever aid was being given out, although, again, I don't know one single person who's ever gotten it here, is not happening. the people of Haiti feel that they've been completely left out of the conversation, and indeed that is one of their key demands, is that they need to be informed what's happening, and not just informed, but they need to be part of it, and they currently aren't. It's a great question mark for everyone as to what the UN and the U.S. and the government of Haiti and some of the very large international non-governmental organizations are, in fact, discussing. But now, what, 7 or so weeks, I don't know, many weeks after the earthquake, the response in terms of assistance from the top is quite painfully absent. But I will say that from the bottom, it's phenomenal. The Haitian people have once again risen to the occasion, and there are such fantastic displays of solidarity, of people helping each other, and such a tremendous resilience and creativity and courage in the face of this. It's really quite impressive and a model for all of us.
You mentioned in your writings that in February, over 50 grassroots groups met in Port-au-Prince to develop their own political strategies. Can you talk about the social movements organizing around the rebuilding of Haiti and what demands are being made by the social justice movements?
Yes, the social movements have stepped up in a big way. Even though most of them don't have offices, they're working in borrowed yards. 3 or 4 people are sharing a desk. There's almost no access to telephone, reliable telephone or internet. But they are just doing extraordinary work of insisting, again, that the government of Haiti be a central part of rebuilding, that this not be an excuse for Haiti just to become a protectorate, and also saying that the citizens of Haiti need to be party to the process. There needs to be active participation from the citizenry, and they need to benefit. Some of the demands, first and foremost, is an end of the U.S. occupation. It's quite notable that in 1994, when the U.S. formally invaded to restore President Aristide after a military coup, that there was an executive order and the U.S. Congress was involved. The exact same number of U.S. troops have disembarked since January 12th, but without any formal notice or really anyone in the U.S. even being aware that the U.S. has just occupied the country. And people are very shocked by this. They say this is not a humanitarian response. It's a purely military response, and they're very clear that they do not want to live under a U.S. occupation. So that's the first demand. As I mentioned, participatory democracy is very key in people's minds. Also critical to anything, and this is taking up lots of time, is rebuilding with a very different economic paradigm. That is not one that serves the very few, but one that puts people's needs first. So the social movements are demanding that there be a tremendous effort to provide basic services and to guarantee them as rights. Also part of that rebuilding is privileging agriculture. Haiti has a population that is anywhere between 65 to 80% peasant farmer, that number varying depending upon whom you ask. And what they are saying is that they do have the capacity to feed the nation, and if agriculture were rebuilt, that's a vast number of people who would be employed. And it would also lead towards national sovereignty as well as food sovereignty. So the demand for the government to fully invest in agriculture and to enact land reform, which is essential for that project, is critical to people's demands. There's also a large focus, as you might imagine, on protecting the environment. Only 0.5% of its land is covered with trees, and there are other serious environmental problems here, so people are asking that once again, instead of profit being at the center of rebuilding, that the environment be taken into consideration. And another element that is key to all demands that I've seen coming out is a priority on women's rights and also on children's rights. There is a thriving child slavery system at work here. And many children are especially vulnerable now because they have lost their parents. Either their parents were killed in the earthquake or they have been abandoned by their parents. And so putting women's rights and the protection of children at the center of the agenda is also another key demand.
Do you think that those new movements, social movement, includes Aristide's party?
Certainly there are a lot of people from Lavalas, his party, who are engaged in the mix.
Are they getting supported by NGOs? Because I've noticed that the United Nations Development Fund for Women has argued that microfinance should be central to the reconstruction. And I also noticed that there's a group of feminist activists from Bolivia, Brazil, Costa Rica, Nicaragua, et cetera, that had a feminist international camp, which has been established under the leadership of the Global Fund for Women, et cetera, trying to organize. So what support are these grassroots organizations getting, and do you think that they have any kind of commonality in terms of their vision that the UNIFEM or these feminist international camp has?
The feminist international camp, known as the Myriam Mirley camp, named after one of the founders of the contemporary women's movement who was killed in the earthquake, is going to be formally launched on March 8th, International Women's Day. And it's on the border with the Dominican Republic. It is meant to be a center not only for recuperation of women's, what they refer to here as psychosocial status, but it is also meant to be a camp from which political organizing can take place and where women's movements can regroup and pursue their agenda. So that is a very exciting initiative. There have been tremendous amounts of solidarity from women, as you mentioned, not just in the Dominican Republic, but in many, many, many countries. And I know that women here appreciate that very much. UNIFEM, yes, has been here, and is working on the question of rape. There is a spiraling of rape and of violence against women in the camps because so many women are sleeping in the streets completely unprotected. And so there is a lot of effort going into that. And there are women asserting themselves at all different levels, from a relatively new National Association of Peasant Women, for example, to women taking the lead in grassroots humanitarian aid efforts. It's really beautiful and inspiring to see. I don't actually see that many international people here, frankly, but I know that there is communication happening and some organizing. There is a network, for example, in the U.S., that is meeting every Wednesday and planning their strategies. There definitely needs to be more coordination between Haitian women and their sisters elsewhere, where Haitian women really take the lead in the social and political agenda. The will is definitely there, I think.
Well, Edward, maybe you could talk a little bit about what it is that the Haitian community in the U.S. is doing, if you are working with them, if there's anything that you wanted to add to what Beverly has been saying.
Here in the, you know, in the Haitian-American community, I think, you know, the first stage of it for a lot of us was sorting out where people were, who was alive, who was no longer here. That is, you know, that's still an ongoing process. And that said, you know, the more time goes by and people are dealing with their own personal grief, what's emerging also in all the gatherings that's been happening here. And this weekend, for example, in Miami, there's a grassroots community conference that will happen over 2 days. And yesterday there was at the university a higher education conference. There have been several things planned this weekend for International Women's Day. And I think people are trying to be productive in terms of what they can do. And a community like here in Miami, the little Haiti community near where I live, it's a very challenging situation for a lot of people who are themselves struggling. At times, I think what's left out of the conversation is that, you know, with all the aid and everything that's being pledged, it still will be that every Haitian family, you know, who has relatives in Haiti, becomes, in a way, an aid organization. They're the ones that are going to be putting children back to school. I mean, that's how it's been for so many years, and I think that element of it will remain there. And I see, you know, the way people have already been meeting for the last 20 years or so, there have been this movement of neighborhood organizations, like hometown organizations, where people who gather together and support, for example, kids to go to the schools that they went to or to build schools and clinics in the towns that they come from. And I think these things have stepped up. We've been to several. So all these things are happening in these small ways, and I think Beverly's right, and a lot of people have said it, that there needs to be a little bit more coordination. But in this initial stage, you know, people, you can tell when you're in Port-au-Prince and you go by the Western Union lines, for example, and people have just been trying to offer sort of their individual support. I mean, there's a lot of discussion in terms of what the space is for the diaspora, for, you know, for Haitian-American women, and helping, as Beverly has said, they're following the leads of, you know, finding out what the needs are for their sisters, for the children, and trying to come up with these different programs. But right now, it's still everybody's doing what they can from their end. But ultimately, everyone will be needed as it goes forward. And, you know, as this initial attention wanes and things get even more urgent, say, as the hurricane season approaches, and just as Beverly's saying, can you imagine a hurricane under the circumstances that we have now in the streets of Port-au-Prince and elsewhere? It's almost a horrific thought to contemplate.
I have heard that the Coast Guard has been actively preventing people from leaving Haiti, and that when the rains come, this is going to be a tremendous disaster. And I know, Edward, you've got have already had some experience with immigration and how Haitians are treated as immigrants as compared to other groups in the U.S. Would you like to talk a little bit about that and what some of the fears people may be having about what happens when people are going to be trying to get leave or get asylum or get on boats?
Well, one of the most amazing things that we learned, you know, that I learned after the earthquake was that, you know, you had a kind of a wall of Coast Guard around Haiti. And one thinks immediately that it's to help save people, but it's to keep people in. And immediately there were messages that were being broadcast, you know, by the Haitian ambassador to the U.S. saying to people, stay in or we'll turn you back. And there are people who have been taken off these boats and brought back. When we're looking at it realistically, realize, too, that part of the U.S. policy or part of the U.S. response to this earthquake has been to try and prevent people from leaving. They see this catastrophe not only as an extremely large disaster for Haiti, but also as a potential quote-unquote disaster for them if suddenly people were getting on the boat. So that's a huge part of the response that we have seen. That has to do, I think, with what we've seen with the sort of the militarization of the response, too. Immigration is always factored in whatever U.S. policy, you know, with Haiti. And this time it's no different. There's no different treatment. You know, they've allowed some orphans, quote-unquote, to leave, but the rest of the policy remains the same.
That was an interesting situation where you had some white Christians attempting to so-called adopt, and nowhere do we hear the Haitian American community's voice in the response to that. We only heard what the media, U.S. mainstream media's response was. It was very disconcerting. But
it pained a lot of us, too, when you would see in the media these images of who was adopting Haitian children, and people kept asking me, well, where are the black families or where are the Haitian families adopting? And the thing is about these adoptions, I mean, that people don't realize, Haitian Americans adopt more informally, and they're given the hardest time, you know, in adopting children, even within the family who lose their mother or father. It takes them even longer to adopt. You know, I know a lot of people who try, and they think they're being fraudulent in that. So that part of the story certainly was not told. It just seemed like, you know, you had these white people rushing in, taking these black children that even people who are in the States didn't want. I think that was another sort of a silenced part of this narrative, too. I think even George W. Bush himself felt the dissonance of his swooping in to save Haiti. I mean, that was just like, it just seemed so bizarre. Paul Farmer, the brilliant doctor who, you know, partners in health, Paul Farmer wrote a book called The Uses of Haiti. And I felt in sort of the whole media narrative, everybody from John Edwards to Sean Penn to George W. was getting sort of the uses of Haiti and sort of and claiming their redemption from Haiti. I mean, how incredible that as people are suffering, they can offer these this kind of thing to people. You have this other part, and I'm glad that this is being told also. This story of, you know, this the vultures circling and everybody wanting a piece of this disaster. I mean, against the uses of Haiti, and as people are suffering the most, you know, people stand to make the most money, and they know it. And what terrifies me in the mix is that you may have, you know, all these people who are coming in, you know, the security firms Bill's article mentioned, and others who are coming, you know, who see this pot of gold there, that will they teach anything to the people in Haiti? Will people in Haiti get jobs from this? Or will this just be the same kind of thing we've seen all over and over again? People come in, they make their money, they leave, and people are left in their misery.
So have you seen a coalition between the African-American community and the Haitian-American community occurring in the U.S.? Or where do you see the Haitian-American community getting support for its issues, both around immigration, the slavery that occurs here in Miami with the sugarcane, and around Haiti?
There has not been really a coalition. And in places like Miami, which is a very sort of, it's like New Orleans of pre-Katrina, where Miami's a city that on its surface appears like a very rich city, but it's one of the poorest cities in the United States. So you, at least in this community here, it's not the same as New York, but New York has other issues. And the Haitian community here is competing with other poor communities for scant resources in a very poor city. So that makes it very hard to build certain coalition, because everybody is just fighting for a very small pie. The earthquake, though, it's one of the first times that I've seen all these communities sort of reach out and try to see how they can help here, both here and with, for example, the thousands of children who are coming from Haiti into the school system here. That's something that, you know, Miami is sort of the next step from Haiti. We're going to feel a lot of the after effects. And the communities here, the Cuban, the other Caribbean communities, the African-American communities, have been very supportive in that process of helping some of the people who have come here through the hospitals, through, you know, the children who have come unaccompanied, and all these other issues immediately following the earthquake.
I wanted to get back to talking about women in Haiti, and perhaps maybe both of you could talk a little bit about the situation for women in Haiti, you know, historically.
You know, with everything relative to Haiti, women as well as everything else, there are two very sharply focused perspectives. One is just how terrible things are as a nation that first emerged in slavery and has continued to suffer under tremendous amounts of colonialism. Well, as Edwige says, a country that is being used by many for various purposes, and we certainly see the human suffering as a result. But with women, as with so many other things in Haiti, including most everything post-earthquake here, we also see the most extraordinary levels of organizing and breadth of vision and courage. And that is very much in play today as women are trying to retake their lives from the point at which they were before the earthquake. And women here have suffered, as you might imagine, socioeconomically in very many regards, just living in abysmal poverty, trying to raise their children with as much dignity and opportunity as possible, but really with constraints all around them, socially, economically, and politically. And yet they never give up. They don't have that luxury. And they continue to believe that things can be better, and that they certainly know that it will be up to them to make it so. So I would say that the continuity is certainly there. As I mentioned, it's inconceivable that these folks could become poorer, but in fact they are dramatically poorer now, and opportunities are very much closed off for them. For example, all schools in Port-au-Prince are closed. No one knows when they will be open.
People have lost everything. For example, the little merchants on the streets have lost most of them, since it was mainly the poor houses that were destroyed, and they were destroyed en masse. They've lost what little merchandise they had, so there's no way to make any income. And even if they had the merchandise, to whom would they sell it? Because no one else has any income to buy. So the conditions of their daily lives have just really, really spiraled downwardly in very vicious ways. But the continuation of their stepping out and stepping up and organizing to create a very different nation and society for themselves, as well as the whole greater country of Haiti, is really something to see. It's something that has impressed me and just about everyone else who's ever paid attention to Haitian women. The incredible multiplicity of efforts in which they have been involved, and the proactiveness of their efforts. They have one of the earliest feminist movements, one of the earliest women's rights movements anywhere in history that I know of. And they are continuing that today, and it is just so inspiring and visionary. And again, that's really mirrored in the whole larger movement in Haiti today. We've been talking about some of the horrible elements that have emerged from this earthquake, and there's no way to overstate that. And yet everywhere, from grassroots women's organizations who are meeting in the camp, who are continuing to meet even though their offices have been destroyed, even though, you know, they're sitting there in the midst of filth, to some of the national women's organizations who are out planning and, as we mentioned, organizing with Dominican women to put this camp up in the border and reaching out to their international sisters. It is something that fills me with a lot of hope and lets me know that Haiti, as always, is going to find a new way to emerge from its current crisis. And people hear hope in a much more just and rights-filled way than they had prior to January 12th.
Could one of you or both of you talk a bit about what was the political and economic situation for women in the last 30, 40 years prior to this earthquake?
Patriarchy is alive and well here, as it is everywhere. There was a colonial influence because when the slaves became free in 1804, after a revolution, the generals basically took up where the French left off and almost immediately created a new form of slavery. And so I'm sure that the male progenitor land passage process was influenced by that. And yet women are, as Edwige said, excluded from many forms of social and economic protections. Women's voices are not automatically pushed to the forefront in terms of peasant issues or even peasant movements, and that some of them are working very hard to ensure that women have equal access to land. And in the land reform movement, there is a big push for women to have full legal and social protection of their land. But the fact that women do not control virtually any property in Haiti is certainly a tremendous hindrance. What women struggle through day after day to keep their children alive is really impossible to state. It's almost impossible to conceive of. More than 50% of people here earn $1 a day, and in fact, that does not mean that they have $1 every day. They might have $1 maybe only 2 days in this particular week, and so what that means is that their children cannot eat except through solidarity. And that's where really this informal economy that is based on mutual aid and solidarity and gifting becomes so important. And I think that the tremendous movement of Haitian people is a direct outgrowth of the level of want and of the level of social and economic oppression of everyone, but notably women, because they have had to adapt in so many ways. So, yes, the rates, as we spoke about, are just on the ascent right now. And, in fact, it's only been in the last decade or so that women have actually had legal protection against rape. Here I know of one multi-year study held in Cité Soleil where 100% of women who responded said that their first sexual experience was rape, 100%.
And again, that is happening more. We know that women and their children are more vulnerable always than men in conditions of crisis. And certainly we are in full crisis mode here in Haiti.
And Edward, you mentioned that you got into writing because of the history of oral storytelling in Haiti and the importance of that in resistance. And I learned in the book, Walking on Fire, that there was this inspiration that came from the ancestors. Could you talk a little bit about that history of the goddesses of love, et cetera, that helps provide for resistance for women and survival?
I always tell people that, you know, I feel like a lot of the women in Beverly's book, I'm an accident of literacy. You know, I come from a poor rural family that sort of did the migration to the city. I grew up in Bel Air, which is a very difficult place that's squashed pretty much right now. So, but what carried me through was the dignity of the women around me, that even if they were maligned by the society they lived in, looked down upon, they were goddesses to me. Because of how they maneuvered their lives and how they sort of focused towards the future, like they could see hope for their lives in us and in my generation and the rest of us. And they were women who didn't read, who didn't write, but who had so much sense about the world, who can really, if you gave them $10, could make 100 out of it, because they had to, because there were so many people counting on them, who called on their faith, you know, who identify with the struggles of women throughout history, who knew all of that somehow through this whole history that was passed on from women from Anakauna, the native chiefess who was in charge of Liugan in this area that I came from before the colonial period. And then Vodou women like Erzuli Frida, who have so much power. And I think they drew from all of that to be the women that they are, because this is a society that even before this moment, you know, during the dictatorship and before that, this is a society that demanded a lot from its people, its poor people, its poor women. You have no choice. Like when I return to Haiti and I see women sleeping on the streets with little babies. And for me, those babies, those little girls, those little boys represent what Haiti is at this moment, the fragility of it. And it's all cradled in a woman's arms as the rain is beating down on her head. All of that is, it's sad, but it also, it's inspiring. It's what can give you hope. You know, I can only hope, and it's a naive hope that if something was made of my life, if I'm able to sit and speak to you today, it is truly because of the wisdom and the care and the love and really the struggle, the extreme struggle of a lot of amazing, amazing men, but also more so amazing women.
What I would like to close with, this may seem counterintuitive because the situation in Haiti is so very, very dire at this moment. And it certainly will be for a long time into the future. And yet, people here, both in organized movements as well as just average citizens on the street, feel so clearly that this can be a tremendous opportunity to construct a new Haiti. I've heard people say we don't want to reconstruct Haiti because it does not serve us in any way to return to what we had before. Chavan Jean-Baptiste, who's one of the peasant leaders here, likes to say the clock is set at zero. And that is a very broad sentiment. People are extremely committed to doing what they need to do to work for a new economic model, a new social model. Women are certainly very engaged in trying to create new gender relations of power. And there are many alternatives surfacing, everything from, as I mentioned earlier, huge outpourings of solidarity to plans being drafted by alternative development organizations as to what a just economy could look like. And the Haitian people have so much to teach us in the U.S., so much, such a history, a very different approach to constructing society and to continuing to stand for justice and for human relations that truly put the human at the center of that relation instead of things and instead of money. And once again, we have a lot to learn from Haitians. So I hope that people will continue to watch and listen. Certainly Haiti will be fading from the news. It already is. And yet the story of what it might mean to have, as people say here, another Haiti is possible, to have another Haiti will be going on long into the future. And it is my hope that a lot of the lessons can be brought back to the U.S. to infuse greater democracy and integrity in relations in our own country.
You are listening to Women's Magazine on KPFA Radio 94.1 FM. I am your host, Lisa Detmer.